My sponsor just says, no, you keep going. You start showing up there. My grandma said, well, why don't you come by once a week and I'll cook you a nice healthy meal. You know, a guy like you, you need a nice healthy meal at least once a week. And healthy meal to her was like tons of gravy and a big, huge chunk of meat, you know, and potatoes. You know, this is like the, you know, health food. And so she wanted me to come get some healthy food once a week. And so my sponsor, you show up there and do it. And I started showing up at my grandparents' house. My grandfather would stay in the den and he wouldn't even come out. And I did that for a while, and I told my, yeah, he's not coming out. He's not talking to me. I think I should just kind of not push this deal. No, you keep showing up. And I would continue to show up at his house. And eventually, he wouldn't come out when I first got there, but eventually he started coming out at dinner time. And one of the things that I realized is that I kind of held some things against my grandfather, and my sponsor asked me some of those same kind of questions. Well, what was his childhood like, Kenny? Oh, I don't know. Well, why don't you know? I think, well, I'm not sure why I don't know. He said, well, I know why you don't know. You don't know because you don't care. That's why you don't know. You only care about yourself. Oh, geez. You know? So, well, when you're having dinner with your grandfather, why don't you ask him a little bit about his life? Ask him where he grew up, what's his childhood like. You know, I found out that his father was a really abusive guy. And I found out about what the Depression was like. Asked him, you know, what was World War II like? What was that all about? I heard all kinds of stories. He and his friends, now he'd lost, you know, an uncle that was lost in the war that I didn't know about. And I asked him, you know, well, just good questions. You know, I'd just think about it and I'd say, well, did you ever think we were going to lose the war? And he was like, oh, you know, that's a good question. He said, it was odd that I don't ever remember anybody even talking about that. We just kind of knew. You know, and I kind of started getting a picture of what this guy's life was like and the Depression and kind of how he got to be this guy that was just kind of the pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Because guys like me back in his day would have never survived. You know, I mean, you just, you know, you needed to, you know, I wasn't tough enough for what those guys had. You know, I needed the pampering and the little, oh, we'll give you a little cot over here. We'll nurse you back to health over here. You know, we'll pick you back. Oh, we'll loan you a little money and free food everywhere. And, you know, and so I kind of got this great picture of my grandfather, and we talked. And there was a time I couldn't make it, and I called and I talked to my grandmother and said, hey, I can't make it this week. And she didn't say anything to my grandfather about I wasn't coming over on this Monday night. And I came the next week, and my grandmother said, you know what? Your grandfather was waiting for you last week. He was like, where's Kenny? Oh, he's not coming over tonight. Oh, that's too bad. And he was enjoying our conversation. And it was maybe a year or so into that deal, I was able actually to make the amends to him. And then we'd talk about all kinds of stuff. I got back into the same business working on boats, and I still do that for a living today, work for a commercial fishing company, and I work in management. I don't go out on the boats anymore, but still do that same thing for a living that you know, he took me under his wing and taught me all that stuff all those years ago. And you know, my grandfather got sick. He actually drove to my house to tell me in person, called me up, said, there's something I need to talk to you about, came over, and, you know, just in kind of his hardcore way, he just, well, whatever, they found a little spot on my lung, and he was a chain smoker and worked around asbestos for years in the shipyards and that kind of stuff. And he said, well, they found a little spot on my lung, and whatever will be, but I wanted to drive over here and tell you myself. And he started getting sick, and he needed to move into a smaller place. He was a guy that always worked with his hands. And this was a family that I hid from years. I did not want them even to have my address for fear they would drive by and see what kind of squalor I was living in. And when he moved into a small apartment, because he couldn't, you know, he and my grandmother couldn't maintain this, I had just bought my first house. And I had a garage there, and he would come and tinker in the garage and leave his tools there. And he set up a little smoker, started smoking salmon at my house. And he was around all the time. And he had keys to my house, and it was a beautiful thing because there wasn't a thing in my house that I would be afraid for that man to see. Nothing. And it was just a really great deal. And when he did get sick, you know, I visited him in the hospital many times, and he did pass away. And And, you know, I promised him that I would take care of my grandma, and I continued until my grandma died. I continued going over there once a week for the meals and getting the health food. And his best friend in life came to see him. And I always thought this guy was my uncle when I was growing up. He was always introduced as, I just thought he was my uncle. But as it turned out, he wasn't my uncle at all. He was my grandfather's best friend. But he was a part of the family when I was growing up. And he came to see my grandfather. They were the same age, and it was just two old guys saying goodbye to each other. And he called me at my work and said, "Hey, I've just come from seeing your grandfather, and I'd like to come have lunch with you." And I said, "Well, that'd be great." So he came to my work. We went out to lunch, and he said, "You know, I was visiting your grandfather today, and I'd really like to get to know you because your grandfather told me that he considers you an extension of himself." That's an amends, isn't it? From a guy that didn't want to even come to see me, telling his best friend that I consider Kenny an extension of myself. And, you know, it didn't happen overnight. And I'm really have softened, I think, in the amends process a bit that I don't think, I mean, maybe there is such a thing for some people as finishing amends, but it's not an idea that I particularly am fond of these days, because just for myself, it was a message that was kind of a little harsh for me. And I told you I quit working on those boats and I didn't get sober for 3 years. Well, during that 3 years, I don't remember a lot of stuff that I did, but I can stand here honestly and tell you that I did something every day during that 3 years that I owe an amends for, and a lot of it I don't remember. I sponsored a guy that did these cross-country crime sprees. And he went from one end, from the West Coast to the East Coast, and from the East Coast to the West Coast, and from the West Coast to the East Coast. And it was a crime spree all the way across the country the whole way. And he did that stuff for years. And the idea that of finishing amends, you know, I think it's really become kind of none of my business. I currently, as I sit here today with you all, I don't have any cards. You know, I did get through all of my cards, and it took years for me to do that. I had a lot of financial amends. I had a lot of criminal amends. There was a lot of stuff I couldn't completely take care of, and I had a family by this time. There was some things that I had to consider my family on. There were some things that I had to talk to my wife about. There were some things that I didn't even need to talk to anybody about. I just knew the answer would be no, you're not doing that. You know, we need you here. We don't need you in the penitentiary right now. So I've had to find some other vehicles to take care of some of these things. I had money that didn't belong to me, and I had to find ways to get that back into the hands of the Spirit. And so I've donated a lot of money. I've made some direct amends. Don't get me wrong. You know, I made a direct amends to a dentist office that I ripped off. And that was kind of an intuitive thought. I just was a place that I kept going by and going by and going by. And I finally decided I needed to call the guy. And it was a great amends. I've made an amends and went and knocked on a door of a house that I burglarized. I've went to all of the stores that I shoplifted from that I could remember. Every one of them that I could remember, I have called, and I was instructed to call. Make an appointment with the manager because this guy's a busy guy and he doesn't want you just walking in the middle of his day. You know, call and explain, get an appointment with the guy and go in and make the amends and take some money with you. And so I have done those amends. But there's a lot of these other amends, I absolutely don't remember some things, you know. But I know I owe an amends, so it's none of my business really. When this gets, so I suppose someday it'll get to a place where it's going to be I could call it tithing instead of calling it amends. I suppose it might get to a place where I would call it, a desirable way of life instead of amends. Just this idea of, you know, that this giving is a part of receiving, that, you know, that both hands need to be open to idea. Maybe that'll stop being amends for a while, but I really look at amends now as a way of life. I think this is a deal that's going to be a lifelong journey for me. And I've just recently, in the last year, I came up with two amends at 17 years sober that I totally forgot about. Two amends. I took my daughter to a train to go down and see her grandmother, my mom. And I was in a store where the train was late. We were downtown. They were like, oh, the train's not going to be here for 3 hours. So we went and checked out this little store. And I was in the store with my daughter, and I remembered, my God, I used to shoplift here as a kid. We used to take the bus downtown just to shoplift at this store because it was so easy. And I had totally forgot about ever doing that. And so I got back and I wrote a letter to the guy and asked. I called at one time and, no, the owners weren't available. Owners weren't available. So I wrote a letter. But you can write them a letter. I explained the situation. I sent this letter. And I got a live with my phone number and stuff. And the guy ended up calling me back. And I was able to take care of that amends. And it was just one of those ones I had never remembered. And I had another amends. The owner of that company that I worked for that put me through treatment twice was a family business. And I'd made direct amends to him, but I'd never made amends to his son, who was really an owner in the company. I mean, he was kind of being groomed to take the company over. And he didn't because of his own drug problems. But you know, I'd made amends to but I'd never made amends to the son. And I was having a conversation in business, and somebody said, oh, have you ever seen old Steve so-and-so? And I said, oh, man, I hadn't even thought about him for a long time. But, you know, I absolutely owed that guy an amends. I mean, he was you know, one of the family members that kept me on and helped me out many times. And there were several times when that guy loaned me money out of his own pocket. And I was able to think about that. I hadn't seen this guy in the whole time I'd been sober. Hadn't seen him one time, 17 years. Hadn't seen this guy one time. And I thought, well, I made two cards out. I made one card out for that, for the ye old curiosity shop, that store. And I made one card out for Steve S., this guy that I used to work for. I went and made that amends at the curiosity shop. I was at this little remote airport out in the Aleutian Islands up in Alaska, which is way, it's a little this piece that comes way out. It's in the middle of nowhere. I'm out in this middle of this deal in this little tiny airport, and who do you think I see at that airport? Steve. First time in 17 years I'd had that card made out for probably 2 weeks. And I run into Steve. And that's the way that whole deal has gone. I would actually like to open it up for a few minutes here. It's 2:30. I guess we'll go maybe about 5 or 10 more minutes and just kind of questions and comments, and we'll kind of talk a little bit more. People can ask questions about amends or make comments about amends, and we'll try to take. So with that, yeah, anybody? Yeah. Erica, I've got the microphone here. So.
Thanks. I'm Erica. I'm alcoholic. I had to share this because when we were having lunch, I was sharing with Kenny that during the meditation that this place that I went to was some place that I used to go in college. And I have never gone there in a meditation before, and I was really surprised because of the way that the air smelled, and it was a fall day. And I was walking from campus to the music hall at Bennington College, where I went to college. And, you know, I'm starting to make my amends. I thought I had made my amends, and slowly but slowly more of them are coming to me. And the biggest ones are coming around finding that I am not the same person that I used to be, and that the way that I used to make decisions is really frightening to me, that I was that person. I don't know how I made decisions, but it certainly is not the way I do it now. And when I was coming back from lunch, I went to check my messages, and my first true love from college called me and left me a message. I haven't spoken to him in about 30 years. And I owed him an amends. And I don't know how he found me. He called me to tell me that someone that I know died. And so here's why I'm saying this, is because, you know, this morning, like most mornings, I asked God to show me that you're there. I just need some evidence today that you're taking care of me. And that's what I needed. And, you know, I've been praying to become willing, to be willing to make amends. And all of a sudden, I find myself extremely willing. I called him back right away because I knew I couldn't be here and be present without doing that. And both of us just cried, and it was extraordinary. That's all.
Somebody could flip that switch off. Huh? Does that microphone need to go to anybody else? Can you pass the microphone over here this way?
I'm an alcoholic. Oh. Kenny, if you would just clarify one piece. When I first got sober, and this may just be my perception, I don't think it was, but I used to hear in the rooms of AA that if ever someone did mention the ninth step, which is very, very rare, the meetings I would go to, but inevitably someone would say, well, you know, the step reads, except when to do so would injure them or others, and my sponsor told me I'm others, so if it's going to hurt me, I don't make the amends.
Yeah.
And I heard that, and I thought, well, every amends that I was going to make would hurt me, so I don't have to make them. And I remember I'd been doing the work for a while, and I was leading a meeting at our club in Santa Fe, and I shared my topic was, does not finishing my amends have anything to do with whether I stay sober or not? Because I always want you to put out a topic. That was my topic after I'd shared for a while. And an old timer, a guy with a lot of years, who is kind of a high profile guy, said in the meeting, he said, you got to watch out for some of these sponsors because they'll have you going to jail, and our book says we don't go to jail. And it sounded like fingernails on the blackboard, but I didn't have what it took at, 8 years sober to contradict a guy who had like 30 years sober or something like that. But when I read the big book, it says we have to be willing to go to jail.
Yes.
But we don't rush off to jail and leave our family to starve. But could you kind of elaborate on that a little bit? I think it needs clarification.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I think you're right. It probably does. You know, our book is very clear that when dealing with these things that we are not others. I think that's very clear because it ends up saying, no matter what the price, we have to be willing. And it does tell us, in several places that, and I warn people about this because I work with a lot of people that have some heavy duty amends, that we don't fall on the sword in amends. They tell us that in the book. Oh, it would be really, I don't remember what the word they used. It would have been really great if he would have just went to the courts and said, here I am. And this is the example they give in the big book. But they said, no, we thought maybe we'd handle it a little bit different way. And we had him actually talk to his wife. And there is an amends of a guy that actually goes forward in the church and admits all this stuff. But he got permission from his wife first that this was okay. And then he went and got a permission from his business partner first. The mother of my daughter was with me when I was making my first round of amends. One of the amends I needed to make was to that family that I had, done all that damage to, that had employed me for all those years. And they had actually just hired me back. They hired me back about 6 months sober, and they always said they would. They said, listen, if you ever get your act together, you can come back here, but just don't come around here until then. So about 6 months sober, I went back, and they said, well, we can't give you your old job back. We can't really pay you what we were paying you before, but we can keep you busy around the yard here just kind of cleaning up and working on doing a little stuff on the boats. And so I wasn't going to be a chief engineer. I was going to be just kind of a yard guy and hourly. But I was happy to take it. And she was pregnant, so I had to get her permission. I wanted to make amends to those guys, but I thought, if I make amends to him and tell him that I was the guy that robbed the medical chests off the boat, I was the guy that stole all that scrap metal, because I would sell the scrap metal out of the scrap metal bins for cash, and then the cash would somehow never make it to the dope dealer, but it never really made it to the front office. And I did that a whole bunch of times. So I owed these guys a considerable amount of money, and I came with a total, and I got permission from her first. And she knew what I was up against, that she knew I was in the search for freedom. And she said, well, if you lose your job, you lose your job. And I didn't. I made that amends to those people. And I had very little money. I was going to say, hey, can you maybe take some out of my check or do something? And the guy actually ended up saying that hey, I have millions of dollars, and I don't want to take your money. I really don't, and I'm just glad that you came here. And he said, probably the person, just intuitively, he said, probably the person that you really need to make an amends to is your family. And just, it was just a great guy. He did ask me a lot of questions about alcoholism and drug addiction because he said, I think my son has a problem in that area, and his son did, and I knew it. His son had a big, big problem. The same guy that I made the amends to up in Alaska. But I was able to kind of help him out a little bit with his son. But, that's the important thing. If somebody comes to me with a crime, and I'm dealing with a guy right now on this deal that destroyed some personal property, but it's to the tune of a huge amount of money. And I've told him, you have a right to defend yourself even when you're guilty. That's the way things are here. We have a set of laws that allows you to mitigate the damages even if you're guilty. We don't fall on the sword, so I've had him go find an attorney first, and then he's going to find out, really get all the information on exactly what the story is here, and then talk to his family about it. And I give that advice to a lot of people, to go find an attorney if you want advice on how to set this deal right. Make sure you're talking under, privileged conversations here, and then just tell them what it is you've done. And so those are that. I hope that clarifies it a little bit. We do seek permission. We do make sure that it's not going to harm others. Oftentimes, it doesn't serve a good purpose. And the book tells us this, that it's not going to serve a good purpose for this guy to sit in jail because he won't be able to pay his alimony if he's doing so. For him to go sit in jail would hurt his kids, and that's a story directly out of the big book. Wouldn't work for him. It's going to harm his children if he goes sits in jail. So he had to find a different way to make this amends. So didn't mean he didn't have to pay the money back. Just meaning he needed to find a way where he could get that money to the hands of his ex without going to jail. So, yeah. Tony, do you have a question? Comment?
My name's Tony. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tony.
Thank you. And the two things I wanted to just share, a couple of experiences. The first experience, I'm also a recovered drug addict. I'm an alcoholic, and I kind of just don't remember a lot of stuff. And I have a lot of cards. I had quite a few cards of people I actually even remembered their names. Mm-hmm. Like I remembered their first name and I kept those cards. I mean, I have no idea where to find them. I have no idea, any of that. But I kept the cards. And the one thing I got asked to do this time is that, and I think we got it from Don, is that to sit in readiness and in prayer and envision these people like they're there, and do the amends. Just do it, right there with God and say, you know what, here's the deal. And lay it all on the table, and whatever that amends is, specifically that I make that amends to God, to the Spirit, and to, and if there's any money, the money's always got to go somewhere, in my experience. And if people won't take money, if you insist on it, it's been my experience, if you would tell them, listen, it has to go somewhere. It can either go to you or to charity. You can pick the charity, whatever, They seem to be more willing to take it that way. So I got that instruction this time because I've been holding on to those cards. I've been holding on to them and listen, I really want to make these amends. I'm ready to. I'm willing. And if I ever see these people anywhere, I'm willing to make that right. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And the second story is that... My family, my sister, I went and made amends to my family, my immediate family, and my stepdad and my sister, and my brother, and my mother didn't want to see me, but I wrote her a letter, and I went to go see my sister, and she freaked out. She yelled at me, she swore at me, she says, I don't want to hear those dang amends and blah, 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 and I said, okay, fine, I won't tell you, you know, I don't need to. But I kept calling, and I kept sending the cards, and I kept, you know, just doing this thing. And, you know, last week she called me on the way. I was going to Denver, and, you know, she may have cancer, you know, of the uterus. And, you know, we just talked for a while. It was like, and I have just tried to be a good brother today. And we had the best conversation I've ever had. And I said, you know, I really want to talk to you for a minute. And she's like, you're not going to make one of those amends, are you? And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And it's real obvious you don't want to hear it, you know. But I just said, you know, I really like hearing from you. I love you, and I appreciate it. And I want to, you know, to be in your life if you're willing to do that. And, you know, and I don't know. But it was, I felt free, though. I felt free. I felt like there was no weight on it anymore for me with my family, with her specifically. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's all because of the amends process. And there was a lot more amends. But anyway, that's it. Thanks.
Thanks, Tony. I think we'll kind of wrap up. We've been sitting, I think, maybe a little more than an hour now. It's probably a good time. I will say this, that one of the things I did, and I didn't mention that in this amends, and we can't hit on every little thing, but Tony kind of brought up the thought for me. Is there, you know, there's the deal that says there are some people that cannot be seen. That includes people that have died, people that we can't find, people that we don't remember, those kind of things. I had some cards that were just like, you know, the guy from Milwaukee, you know. I mean, I just knew that I'd burned this guy, but I had no idea. And, you know, I wrote a lot of honest letters. And I used to take them I would just like put like the guy from Milwaukee on the envelope, and there'd be a letter, but I included all those things in it. And I did that same thing Tony talked about. I tried to envision that person in my mind's eye and tried to envision myself saying those things. And I would write all that stuff out, what I'd done. If there was any way that we could ever come in contact, I'd make this amends in person. That if I ever see you, I stand ready to do this. That if there's anything I need to do to make this right, I'd pray that God would make me aware of those things. All that stuff, and I'd put it all in a letter form. And I would put it in the envelope, and I would seal it away. And I used to put it in a post office box. And then I told somebody what I was doing, and they said, well, now you owe the U.S. Post Office an amends, because when a postman finds something like that, he can't just throw it away. He's got a whole procedure and paperwork he's got to do for that piece of mail. So I quit doing that. And I started just throwing those in the recycling. But I actually have a belief in that. I mean, I actually do have a belief that in the spiritual world, when I really do that and I think about that person, that it's, you know, I don't think it's a remote possibility. I think there's a possibility that at that moment that I mail that thing off and that I send that, that that person has a thought, you know, I think I'm done being mad at Kenny. I think I'll let that one go. You know, I really do think some of this stuff does take care of it, but it does talk about writing the honest letters, and I wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of them for this kind of stuff. So, you know, I haven't come across an amends yet. I really haven't. I've had some where I had to tell, well, listen, let me think about this and get back to you. I've had a lot of those, but I haven't had an amends yet that I can't, that where it's just kind of, well, there's no way to make an amends for that. There's always some action to be taken to help to restore some balance to the book. So, yeah, Tom.
One more question. How about graveside amends? Do you have any experience with that?
I do. I made several like that. You know, I had a really good friend, one of my best friends, that died of a heroin overdose. And I always felt really horrible about that. And the last conversation he and I ever had was a conversation about, you know, he was in AA for a while and got sober. And then I was in AA and the last conversation we had with each other was I was sober and he wasn't. And the conversation was, man, wouldn't that have been nice if we could have just had a little bit of time where we were both sober at the same time? Would have been really nice. And then he died and I owed him some amends and I went to the place where his service was. And I also, you know, I have a belief in the spiritual life that, you know, I made that amends to Jim and I made my amends and I clearly, you know, heard him. I wrote the letter, I read the letter to him and I clearly heard him saying that he was in a better place and that he was glad I was clean and sober. And I had several of those kinds of intuitive thoughts. A guy that I sponsored died, and I'll tell you more about that story. But a guy that I in the 12 steps, really powerful story. I'll tell you tomorrow morning. This guy's name was Gary, and he died while I was sponsoring him. And you know, I had some amends to make there. I had done some things in sponsorship that weren't really very kind. And I felt horrible about it. And I went and did a graveside amends with Gary. I did a graveside amends with my stepfather I told you about, and I had some amends to make there. And they were very, very powerful amends. And I treat those in that light of some people cannot be seen with them. We write the honest letter and take that letter to a place. And I'd encourage everybody to do that, you know, to if you have those kind of amends. Write the letter and go to the grave, and of course a lot of people don't use graves these days, but go to a place where you remember the person, or that was a special place to that person, or a place, and make those amends, because those are, I'm glad you brought that up, some of the most powerful experiences I've had is the making the amends and reading the letter, but the really powerful thing is the listening. You know, that's a big powerful part of amends, but the listening part, I mean, you will be amazed at what will happen if you'll put yourself out there in the spiritual life a little bit. It's really cool. So, yeah. So we'll go ahead and stop the burning portion of this, and we will stay for a second and talk group conscience just for a second. Okay, welcome back, everybody. We're going to have one more session here today, tonight, and then we'll have an open AA meeting tonight, as we talked about, and then we're going to have a couple of sessions tomorrow morning. We'll end by 11:30 or so, and we'll have I think we'll start again tomorrow morning around 9 o'clock. And tomorrow is going to be entirely devoted to Step 12, And so we're really doing good. What we want to talk about here in this session that we have, and we'll do our very best not to make this a really long, drawn-out session. So I'm going to get to some points. The stuff that's up on the board, you can kind of allow it to make you a little nervous right now, but you don't have to worry about it too much, and we'll get to it eventually. But this says sex, security, and society, and these are kind of, this is kind of some 12 and 12 woo-woo stuff that we're going to get to, just because I thought for this group it'd be something that's a little different than it might be kind of something fun. So we're just going to approach it from that standpoint. One of the things that was kind of a real focus point for Bill at the time of his life when he wrote that book was that, you know, a big part of the problems that alcoholics have outside of drinking, and I would guess this is true for Al-Anons too, is this idea of kind of these God-given instincts gone awry. That we have a God-given instinct for sex, and we have a God-given instinct for security, which means that, you know, there's a God-given thing that we'd have a home, some friendship, certain amount of money, these kind of things, because if you don't, you'll freeze to death. You know what I mean? It's a God-given thing. Society is we have a God-given instinct to kind of circle up and to get with a group of people. People will kind of find groups of people to join and join in community with and family and those kind of things. But, you know, one thing that I could say for myself is that well into sobriety, I find myself demanding way more than my fair share of these things. And this is really this idea that Bill had, that we always want more than our fair share of these God-given instincts. I want more of my fair share of sex, security, and society. And those are kind of the three things that he actually calls, in the 12 and 12, he calls this last one society, he calls that prestige. And he uses both words, but prestige he uses primarily. I kind of like when he uses the society word for these instincts, but prestige, and he kind of gets into that. So we're going to look at some of this stuff from this avenue of the 10th step being the step where we continue to take personal inventory. When we're wrong, promptly admitted it. We're going to look at some of the beautiful things that the big book has to say about step 10 and 11. And we're going to look at this outline as a way to kind of write some additional inventory, maybe after you've been sober for a while and after you've gone through the steps, you've come out the other side. Maybe there's a few more things that you can look at in your life that will be helpful. If this is helpful for you and you can write it down, then that's great. I want to make something really, really clear here that I absolutely believe, and that's that when we sit down with a new person, we take them back to the foundation, which is the big book. You know, that was the, and I said this Friday night, it's the grandmother of all 12-step material. It doesn't matter what fellowship you're in. You know, this is where we start. So when a new guy comes to me, we don't do any of this. We don't do anything else. I'm doing this because this group is maybe ready for it, and it's going to be something a little different and fun. And the 10-step directs us to do these kinds of things in the big book. And I'll show you where I get this idea from. But we're going to open the book up a little bit. We'll look at page 84. If you don't have your book, you know, I'll... But it talks about that after step 9, it says, we vigorously commenced this way of living. This is about the middle of the page. As we cleaned up the past, we have entered the world of the Spirit. As I'm making amends, I've done this. Remember, we're headed for the Spirit's awakening as well. The step says we've entered the world of the Spirit. You don't enter the world of the Spirit 3 after you get through the stuff and you're starting to make amends. And that was definitely my experience, that in step 10, you know, I had entered the world of the Spirit. My life was different. I was on different terms. And they kind of give us some of these promises down at the bottom of 84 and 85 that we, you know, I think this is pretty common stuff. And most people read this, or you don't get to be around A very long, hopefully, before you hear some of these 10-step promises, because they're as beautiful or more powerful, a lot of people think, than any of the promises in the book. And that's the at the bottom of 84. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we'll find that this has happened automatically. We'll see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We had not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And then it parlays into this idea that it says it's easy to get in that place and rest on our laurels. And if we do, we are headed for trouble, because alcohol is a subtle foe. And that insanity of alcohol can return. So we've really got here, it says, is we've got this daily reprieve. We are not cured of alcoholism. I'm in the middle of 85 now. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And then here's a sentence that I want to really use as kind of our focus for this session here. Every day is a day we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How best can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. And it goes on. They use a lot of words in here. If you go back and look at this, they use words that are called inspiration, the intuitive thought, the decision. They use a word in here called the vital sixth sense. That this comes to play. Once you've entered the world of the Spirit, this vital sixth sense. So what are the five senses? Somebody just name them for me real quick. The five big ones. Silas. He's got it. What was that again?
Touch, taste, smell, sight, hearing.
Yeah, he's got all five. Touch, taste, sight, feel, and hearing. Yeah. So there is the sixth sense. You know, these are the things that we use to perceive this world around us. They're the senses that we use to as our sensory perception. This is how I sense what's going on in this room. I'm using all five of these senses at the same time right now. And I use them all to kind of sense what's going on, what's the people around me. I can use it to sense danger or smell. You know what I mean? I can use these senses. And then they said, but now we're going to start using this vital sixth sense. And that is, some people call that intuition. Some people call that spirituality. Some people call that, there's women's intuition, they call it. So how many people in here would say that they are in touch with this vital sixth sense? Yeah, somewhat, yeah. And that was most of the people that raised their hands. A few that didn't, but everybody will raise their hands when I clarify what we're talking about here. It is a capacity that we all have. It's a capacity that we all have. And it's the best one, and I think that's the reason that this term, the women's intuition has come along, because to give people I like to use the most clarifying example that I can when I'm talking about stuff. And the most clarifying example of this that I can think of is the mother. She's got her back turned. The kid walks through the room. What's wrong? Nothing. No. Right? And we all know what that's about. It wasn't the five senses that she picked up on. It's the sixth sense, my kid is in trouble, right? And that capacity, we all have that capacity. You enter into the world of the spirit and you start getting that with the people that you work with, or maybe you get an inspiration in a group like this, you get a feeling like maybe I should say something about this, or maybe I should talk about that, or you kind of get to where they say that we start, using this vital sixth sense as we come to rely on it. We come to rely on it. Right before that, they said the sentence that we're going to focus on, and the reason I wrote some of these down to give people an idea where we're going here, it says that every day, and there's two musts in that paragraph, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will for us into all our activities. So if there's something in the 10th step that I must do, and it's this vision that I have that I must carry into all my day's activities, I think it would be wise to have a vision of God's will for me. What is vision? What is God's will for Kenny? And it seems like a big question, but really it's come to my experience that it's really not as hard as it seems. We talked about this a little bit on Thursday night at the potluck that we had at Tom and Juanita's. We kind of got a little discussion going, started talking about the heart's desire a little bit. And I said, well, I'll touch on that at the retreat. The heart's desire is God's will for us. I really have come to, I really believe that. I think there's more to it than that. The heart's desire, my friend Emmett Fox says that it's not a secret. People like to say, oh, I don't know what God's will is for me. Oh, no. He says, Emmett Fox says, it's that very thing that you don't want to tell anybody. It's that very thing that you don't want to stand up and say that, this is what I'm going to do. It's that very thing that causes all this fear in your life. No, he says, you can't hide behind that deal. He says, you know. And he says it much more eloquently than that in his, he's got a little book that and it's called, just a little 10 or 12 page pamphlet. And if you ever see it around, you can pick it up. It's called Your Heart's Desire by Emmett Fox. My deal is pretty easy. It's pretty easy. And I got quiet, got placed on this path a long time ago by a great sponsor. I got quiet and I thought about it. And, it's an easy deal for me, because what comes to me when I think about my heart's desires is I love working with drunks. I just love it. So I didn't have to really go very, very deep. I got past the, being a rock star. Well, I had to run that by my sponsor. And he says, well, Kenny, you don't play the guitar. You can't sing worth a crap. You're not very good at writing poetry. So, maybe you need to look a little deeper. And I'm just kidding about that. I actually didn't come up with that. But, you do need to kind of think on a deeper level, like, is this really God's will for me? And search. But it shouldn't be a secret. People have these intuitive thoughts. you know, my wife loves being a mother to my daughter and to our son. She loves being a wife. She loves working with alcoholics. I mean, she's kind of found her heart's desires is pretty simple. She's pretty simple, likes to live a pretty simple life. You know, when I looked at that, the good news for me is that there's no shortage of raw material, you know, when it comes to my heart's desire. You know, it's not too hard to find hopeless drunks. And you know, the reason that kind of choked me up when I thought about that is that I have a job, you know, an employment, and it's actually a fairly big job. You know, I manage a big company. We got about 75 employees, and you know, it keeps me very, very busy. And I love doing it, and I'm of service to a lot of people. You know, these guys that I work with, they love me. They really do. They don't come out and say it, but you know, I get hugs from the guys that I work with, and these are big, gnarly fishermen, Alaska fishermen, you know. And when I come up and see them, and the boat's hitting the dock, man, these guys are happy to see me when I fly up and see them, and they want, oh, what's going on? They want all the information. And I got sick a couple years ago. I needed to take a little kind of step back from my job a little bit and get some treatment for hepatitis C. And I told one of these guys, they cried when I told them what was going on. So I got a really great deal with my work. And my family, you know, is just a huge part of my life. And I'll talk more about my family. But, you know, my wife never had any children. And she desperately wanted children. She prayed for children. And then she met me, and my daughter came to live with us just a short time after that. And then she was like, God, no, I want one of my own children. And we tried for about a year, and that's what we decided. Well, if it's God's will, we'll try for her about a year. My wife is, she probably, I don't know if she'd like me to say this or not, but my wife is 46. And so, you know, we didn't have a lot of time, but we did try for a period of time, and we weren't able to have our own child. And she was still praying, but she wasn't specific in her prayers. And God gave us this 220-pound bouncing baby boy, you know, this 15-year-old kid that came to live with us, and that's been 5 years ago now. He's 20 years old, and he's just a great kid. You know, I have this vision of family life. But the heart's desire, and there's nothing, you know, I just have a great life in those areas. But I'm telling you, when I am, and there's people that know what I'm talking about. I just caught Tom's eye there, and I just know, you know, that he and I are on the same page, Juanita and other people, that people are on the same page. Man, when I'm working with a drunk, and it's working, shit, there's nothing better than that. When it's really working, it's just such a great thing. It just really just, you know, I mean, I got this purpose in my life. It's just such a great thing. And, you know, the book tells us to do this, to like, look at what is your heart desire? What is God's will for you? And the other thing that Fox says is, he says, you know, God doesn't play tricks. This is not the God I believe in. He doesn't put something in my heart and then not give me the ability to accomplish it. You know, if that's there, it's there for a reason. You know, these things are there for a reason. So it says we have this vision of God's will for us. And that's what I've done here. We people, I think, here know what the new ideal is when we write our sex inventory. And for those of you that don't, you know, we kind of write this sex inventory, and then he says, well, we go back and look at it, and we use this as a basis for a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And my sponsor actually had me write that out and bring it as part of my fifth step, this new ideal, that from now on, you know, this is the type of person that I want to be in a relationship, that I'm going to get to be friends first with somebody before I have sex with them. And I'm not putting any morals into the deal, because, you know, everybody write their own new ideal, and I'm not the judge of what should go into that. But this is just a couple things. So with this, we kind of do the same thing, and we come out of this with a vision of God's will for me in all my day's activities. Sex is an area that I need to look at. And there's some different areas, like, and I break it down, and so you can write three, and three, there'd be nine new ideals if you wrote this inventory. And this is an inventory of just looking at what my vision of God's will is for me. So I have something to carry in to all my day's activities. Sex for pleasure. And like I said, we got to be comfortable talking about sex. And I'm not entirely comfortable, probably not as comfortable as like, what's the lady on TV? Dr. Ruth. You know, I'm not like a Dr. Ruth here, but we got to get comfortable because this area, you know, every person that we ever sponsor that comes to us is going to have problems in this area. And this is helpful. You know, where am I with sex for pleasure? You know, I have to like write a little new ideal about that. Just to, and I'm, don't get carried away with this. Just do like one or two sentences, sex for pleasure. And I'm not, we're not saying what's right or wrong, just what comes to you. You know, I'm married, so mine is going to be different than a person who's single. You know, a person that's single, you know, their sex inventory, that these new ideals and this vision of what God's will is for them and all their day's activities is going to look different than mine because, you know, a single person in AA is probably going to date a little bit maybe before they find Mr. or Mrs. Right. You're going to date a few people and this idea of sex for pleasure is going to come into the factor. You know, where am I with that? Well, I'm okay with that as long as my wife is. I don't want to try to be selfish and self-centered about this, so I have some ideas on that. This is a big one, reproduction. You know, if you're going to be partnered up with somebody, it's nice to have a vision of what God's will for you is in this area of reproduction. For me, now I know, you know, I know that we are not going to be having any children, so that's an easy one. But for a lot of people, they kind of, you know, if you're going to be having sex, you should think about what is your idea of reproduction and where does that go? Yeah. This last one is called release. And these are just three areas that actually my current sponsor had me look at. This idea of release can be, you know, if you have a lot of pressure at work or something and you come home and you're using sex as a way to release or sex as a way. It can also be masturbation. You know, where am I with that? And a lot of people get hung up about that issue. You know, what is compulsive? What is not? You know, is five times a day, is that compulsive? You know, what's my idea here? No. Yeah. So this area of release is the idea that people that, and we all use sex as kind of a release from the, you know, I mean, it's a way to release tension and stuff in our lives, and it can be sex with another person or it can be masturbation. But, you know, it's an area that we can look at, like, what's my idea, this vision? And then security is, you know, I broke that down into financial, emotional, and health. A vision that I can have every day that I take into every day, that all my day's activities. Financial is important because I have realized that, you know, I went out and got a guy that knows a lot about finances, and he, you know, did all these spreadsheets for my wife and I, and, you know, he told me I can't retire for a long, long time. That I got to, you know, keep saving, and we got to plan, and, you know, financial security, where I'm at with that. Emotional security. What is my, I want to become a more peaceful, more, I want to be a vision that I carry into every day's activity, that I want to be more peaceful, more accepting, more open-minded, more relaxed. This is a long-term deal for me, and the deal that I've realized is that I'm thinking of an example here, but I think it was Don about 34 years sober when he died. 37 years sober when he died. And, you know, he is a very peaceful guy, very peaceful and calm. But, you know, and I've met a lot of these guys like that. And, you know, what I think brings that about is they are doing this work that we are doing, but they've been doing it for a long, long, long time. So I don't reasonably expect to be as calm and serene and peaceful as Don at 17 years sober, as he was at 37 years sober. I just want to carry this vision of God's will, that I want to continue moving in that path emotionally. You know, and there's a lot of talk about this in the 12 and 12, this emotional sobriety. Where do we really, you know, what's my vision of God's will for me in this emotional sobriety? He talks about emotional hangovers. You mean you ever lost your cool with your kids? Huh? Yeah, me too. And there's an emotional hangover that goes with that. I mean, I'll beat myself up really bad. I'll feel guilty and terrible, last for days. And, you know, emotional hangovers. And it's from not, you know, having a clear vision of what God's will is for me in all these days' activities. And And my daughter tells me that now. She tells me, you know, you're much calmer than you used to be. You know, I mean, she's 15 now. She's seen this progression in my sobriety. And it actually has been a long time since I've lost my cool. I was out in our back. This was several years ago, but I was out in our backyard. And I come home from work, and instead of this idea that I get to come home and mow my lawn, the idea was what? I have to come home and mow this goddamn lawn. After working all day, and I came home, and here's the boy, and he's laid out on the couch with, you know, my couch, my clicker, my TV that I got for Father's Day, right there, and he's watching it all kicked back. My daughter's on the other couch. My wife is kind of cooking, and, you know, I think she's probably gone up and got her nails done today and went to the gym, and, you know, and I got to come home and mow, you know, I got to come home after working all day long and try to get this lawn mowed before it gets dark, and my lawnmower wouldn't start, and I was getting madder and madder and madder. And I beat the crap out of this machine with a rake. I mean, I and I just beat the crap out of this lawnmower. So then, not only did I have to build a new lawn, but I had to try to patch all these parts together to get this thing to run again. But I came up for dinner, and everybody in the house was just... And I turned to Shannon, and I said, "Did you guys hear that?" "Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah." You know, and the whole family was like that. Just everybody was just like, "Don't talk to Kenny for a second," you know. And I don't know that that's the last time that I'll act out in that way, but it's been a while. And the thing about that story is that, you know, it's this says in here, what we just read, it should continue for a lifetime, this deal. Continue for a lifetime. And that's really what I believe about this process of continuing with amends and this process of continuing to go and look at what vision of God's will is for me in all these days' activities. I've got emotional health. What's my vision of God's will for me for health? And I'm sure that, you know, I can lose some weight. I can go to the gym. I went to a recent... I am good about going to my doctor's appointment and getting, you know, things checked out. I do have a liver deal I watch and closely. And the health is something... But I'm taking care of things for the most part. But I went to my last deal, and the doctor basically said, "You're fat. And, you know, you need to take this weight off." And people, you know, this liver deal is kind of, you know, the national disease of Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever. I mean, it's a very prominent thing in AA, so a lot of people have this condition, and people who have it know that, you know, you can't, there's a lot of medicines for like high blood pressure and overweight and stuff. You can't take that when you got a bad liver, so you just got to take care of yourself. You can't get to that point where you need those kind of medicines, because those medicines kind of fry the livers of people that have drank too much. I've got this deal written out, and I've got some with me here, and I would share it with anybody that wanted to see what I have written. But I do have a written for all these things, written vision of God's will for me in all my days. And my vision for health is that I eat better, that I exercise, which I'm not doing a great deal. But I went to this doctor's appointment. He told me, "Yeah, you're overweight, Kenny. You know, you got to kind of take care of this." And I told him, "Well, God, my wife's in the gym every day, you know." And he said, "Well, Dad, it's not doing anything for you, you know. I mean, it's good that your wife is working out, but you know, you maybe have to go yourself." So I've got some work on this, but I know what the vision of God's will is. And then in society, I've got three areas here: family. My vision is that, you know, that I'll be a loving father, that I'll spend time with my children, that I'll be a loving and faithful husband, that, you know, I've got a lot of things. I spend time with kids, you know, try to do family vacations. I've got a lot of things that kind of came out when I had this new ideal for my future family life. Work life. My work life is that, you know, I really believe in this idea that when I go to work, that I go there to be of service, the same way I go to an AA meeting, that I go like, what is it that I can bring to the table today? What is it that I can be to the table today? My current sponsor, Tim C., he's a real hard guy to talk to about this stuff, work and stuff, because Tim is a janitor at one of the big Native American casinos up in Washington, night janitor. And he tells me that his vision is, you know, when he walks in there, he says, "You know what, Kenny? I own that casino up there." "Oh, you do? Yeah." He says, "I own that place. When I go in there every day, I own that place. All these other people are working for me." He said, "You know, that whole deal is all designed to give me a paycheck. That's why they've got that up there. The whole thing is designed so that Tim gets a paycheck at the end of the week." He's a really humble guy. So he just cruises around and sweeps up and does his thing. And he says, "Oh, yeah, I've got other people that take care of all this other stuff. I don't have to worry about any of it. Other people are taking care of it. I just worry about this one little thing here." That's his casino up there. That's his casino. So he's kind of got that vision of what God's will is for him, is to be a worker among workers. In the big book, or the 12 and 12 talks about that. You know, are we trying to play the big shot? Are we always trying to get to the top? Or if we can't get to the top, do we play the martyr and just kind of all the way to the bottom? Like, okay, well, then I'm just not going to do anything. It's not my job kind of stuff. Or am I a worker among workers? So we come up with that. I mean, I go to work 5 days a week at least, and I better have a vision of what God's will is for me on the job, or it's going to drive me crazy. And I don't mind telling them at the end of the day that I'm going home. I know there's a lot going on here, but I'm going to go home and be with my family. They know and support my AA work. They know that's a part of the requirement for me to be there, is that I get some time off to do some AA stuff. Community is where AA falls. And not just that, but the big book really talks about this a lot, that we might start paying attention to other things in the community, people who are not alcoholic. But the community is kind of 12-step work. It's you know, one of the things that I had resentment about, and we won't get political here, but I had a resentment about politics and stuff. And, you know, the thing was is that, yeah, I was mad about stuff, and I wasn't involved. You know, I did at least vote, but I didn't really do much. And I'm doing a lot more of that stuff now. I'm trying to educate myself about how things work and educate myself more about politics and what it is that I might be able to do to get involved in the community. And we have a homeowners association where I live, and so we participate in that and send our check off. And I don't go to the homeowners meetings, but my wife does. But it's probably the same thing as, maybe that's the same thing as the health, yeah, and the gym. But, I do participate in that, you know, and I support the things that they come up with. So this is just kind of a short, fun thing that we can come up with to give us this idea that the big book clearly says, you know, that every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. So I better know what those activities are. And this is a pretty good way to break them down into sex, security, and society. And to look to see, are my instincts gone awry in any of these areas? Am I trying to strive for prestige? You know, a great guy one time said this, and it's a little flattering, and I don't mean that to make it that way. And I would tell you, and I hope people realize this and recognize this, not just for me, but for anybody, you know, is that if anything I say here or have said here this weekend comes across at all arrogant or egotistical, I hope people will just recognize that as a shortcoming and a character defect on my part and not a part of this message that I'm delivering. And I hope that you'll take that to heart with all of the people when you hear people in meetings and stuff, that I have that character defect just as much as anybody. And the reason I say that, to clarify this a little bit, a guy that I have a great deal of respect for told me one time, he said, "Kenny, you know, you have a real gift. But the problem is, you have a gift that kills most of the people that have it." And it really humbled me a bit. And I try to remember that a lot of people in AA that get, you know, to where they're sponsoring a ton of people, these people get drunk just like everybody else. You know, a lot of them don't stay sober. They get carried away, and pretty soon they start believing their own stuff, and they're preaching more than they're actually doing their own deal, and the insanity of alcohol returns. One of the biggest things that I think happens is that And I've noticed this with people that I've sponsored that relapsed and stuff. One of the things that really happens when somebody relapses and they come back and we talk about what it was that happened, almost invariably, almost without exception, there was something going on in their life that they weren't telling people about. They were cheating on their husband. They had a gambling deal where the gambling deal was way out of hand and they were hiding money. They had a sex addiction of some kind where they were into pornography or something like that. There was something going on where one of these areas had kind of gone awry and they weren't telling people about it. And they weren't being honest. They weren't tent-stepping that stuff. They weren't getting it out there. The tenth step is to continue to take this inventory. So we're going to move on in a second to the 11th step. But once we have this vision of what God's will is for us in all these days activities, the beautiful thing about that is when you look at the 11th step, prayer and meditation stuff, there's a bunch of questions they ask us on there where we review our day and then we consider our plans for the day in the morning. And when you're reviewing your day, you can say, well, how did I measure up to this? Was I way off in this AA deal and I haven't spent time with my family? Am I way off in the financial deal? The big book warns us about that one. You know, it says in the family afterward that people that get sober will take one of two tacks. One of two. Either once they get sober, they realize, man, I can really make a lot of money now that I'm not drinking and drugging, and they go headstrong into business of some kind, and they start making tons of money, and all the AA stuff kind of goes aside. They try to repair all this financial damage in a month or 2 months or a year. And people, you know, I mean, how often people get sober, they're sober a year, they've started a business, they got four people working for them, they're working all the time, and it says that for those people, it's really hard on the family, because, you know, now dad was drinking, but now he's working all the time. The other way a guy goes, they say, the other tact is a guy might just go headstrong in the AA, and they say that he drives the family nuts because he's telling mother, who's been religious her whole life, about, well, you got to get spirituality and you got to get my brand of spirituality now. And he's, you know, talking about God morning, noon, and night. And he's got these drunks. And they say either way, the family's being, you know, the family's suffering here. But they said that the former is preferable, the big book talks about that, and it's preferable. It says, let him have his way if he's working with drunks. If he goes this financial route, he's headed for trouble. Yeah, Tony.
Is there a specific 10-step practice that you, I mean, you talked about having the vision of God's will for you, which you carry all your activities, but is there a more formal, consistent practice that you do, maybe on a weekly basis or something like that? Do we need to ask that in the microphone?
Yeah, no, I think was that okay? Did that come through all right? The question was, is there a more consistent practice? And the answer is yes. You know, the 10th step, this kind of sets us up to give us an idea of the kinds of things in our lives we should be looking at, this vision of our will. And then in 11, some questions come up. And one of those questions is exactly what Tony is referring to. Is there something that needs to be discussed with another person at once? And that is direct 10th step accountability. And we are very big on that. In my group, we're accountable to each other. I'm accountable to the people I sponsor. I'm accountable to Tim, who is my sponsor. I'm accountable to my family. I mean, this 10th step practice. Currently, my 10th step practice is if something comes up, I will talk to somebody about it. Some of the people that I've sponsored actually do, they do daily 10th steps, and they'll set it up with each other where, you know, I'll call you or you call me every day at 9:30 at night, and we'll kind of 10th step together. And that's a 10th step practice, and it's a very efficient one. I have a group, all the guys that I sponsor, we get together once a month at my house, and one of the things that we do is we circle up like this, and we go around the room, and we tell on ourselves. And we say, well, this is what's been going on with me. These are some things that I've seen that I'm not, I'm off on this, or I'm working too much, or I won't share much more. Part of what our group is that we don't talk about the group. That's part of it. Is that we don't talk about, I can tell you about the format is and stuff, but nothing that's in that group is ever talked about outside the group. We don't even talk to each other about it. I mean, if somebody comes to me and they want to talk a little more one-on-one or something, we will, but if we're out eating or something, we don't say, well, what did you think of what so-and-so said? And then they'll remind us, oh, no, we don't talk about that. So and that's definitely a 10-step practice that I do and encourage all my guys to do, to stay accountable to each other, even after I'm not working with them on a regular basis. So, yeah. Yeah. So the continuing to take personal inventory part of 10, and I think this is what Tony was alluding to, is kind of worthless if you don't fist step on the other side of that. If you're not being accountable to anybody, then it's just me helping me again, and that's kind of led to a few problems in my life. So, yeah.
Did you ever hear Mark Houston talk about the steel on steel groups?
No, I don't. I'm not sure I have.
I don't need to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to ask specific questions every week.
Yeah.
About where are you in the steps, meditation, working with others.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are exactly the questions that we do at my group too. We ask, and we didn't get it from there, but we just kind of came up. We ask, you know, one of the things we do when we go around is we say, you know, what's our current home group? What's our service position in the home group? These are the guys that I'm working with. And you know, we have a couple other things, but just kind of get accountable and make sure we're solidly on all three sides of the triangle. And we're currently working a program that includes all three legacies. And then we go from there. We have a format. And one of the guys in the group, every week, every month, somebody different in the group will kind of bring a format to the group. So they'll bring a spiritual book or something they're reading and kind of offer a lesson for the month. And then when we're done with that, then we go around and do the kind of the admission of faults and stuff. It's really a great, great thing. It's really a neat deal, because when we do sponsor people, you sponsor people, you take them through the steps, and then you usually open that time up to work with some new people, and you're not meeting with those people every week anymore because they're working with others, and it's nice to just have a time that you kind of get back together and remain accountable to each other as a group. So the people that attend this group that I'm talking about are guys that have all been through the steps already. You know, I don't have them start coming to that group until we've finished the step work meeting one-on-one. And then I'll say, okay, well, you start working with other people, give this time and you know, come to the meeting. So with that, step 11. I look at this and we break this down into three parts, or four parts, actually. There's when we retire at night, three parts. When we retire at night, upon awakening, and those two are both on 86, the first few sentences, I just have my guys highlight that. You know, I go through it sentence by sentence, but I have them highlight that. And then I have them look at that part at the very bottom of 87. It says, as we go through the day, we pause. So there's kind of three parts to that 11th step, and it should be a daily practice. And I like that word practice, because They do tell us that eventually this becomes a working part of the mind. And I will tell you that that is true. I mean, it has come true for me that when I wake up, generally, the first thoughts are this upon awakening stuff. You know, I start thinking about my day and thinking about my day ahead and asking some of the upon awakening questions. And I have a morning meditation practice. When I retire at night, when I lay down, I review my day. Some people like to write this stuff out. I don't particularly, so I don't tell other people to do it. But I've heard people that said they got great results when they really got the pen and the paper out and answered those questions. The real thing is that we've got some kind of a measuring stick here, because the 10th step told us that we have a vision of God's will that we carry into all our day's activities. So how did I measure up to this stuff? And they give us a list of questions. Were we resentful, selfish, or dishonest? Do we owe an apology? We won't read them all here, but it goes on. What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we or what we could do for others, or what we could pack into the stream of life? There's a deal on the bottom of 86, and I have to say it's probably the instruction in the book that I miss the most. And it really refers to this deal that we talked about on Friday night, the door to the soul opens inward. You know, all these doors are exits, and you got to push it, and you can get out for panic. But in the spiritual world, you got to relax. And it says, this is the instructions I say that I miss the most of all the instructions in the big book. And it's a simple instruction. It says we relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. It's a long, I think that thing takes a long time to get that. It must. Because I've been trying for a long time to realize that, you know, if I need an answer, and they use those words again here a number of times in here. At the bottom of 86, those words, inspiration and intuitive thought or a decision, are used again. The top of 87, what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration, gradually becomes a working part of the mind. That's that vital sixth sense. They use that word inspiration again at the end. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. And I talked to somebody, I can't remember, I was talking to somebody around lunchtime about that, maybe it was Karen and Juanita, this idea of, or maybe it was Erica, I can't remember, we were all talking, but the idea was that we could kind of come to rely on this stuff, kind of come to rely on these situations. And I've kind of liked to leave behind, like, you know, I have to know whether this is the true one and only way and stuff. I'll just tell you that you know, Bill uses that deal in the second step. We're kind of at odds to tell you why it's better to believe than not to believe. But here's a few reasons and stuff. But I can tell you, you know, it's a happier way of life for me to believe in this stuff. And I don't need any more reason than that. I'm a happier person when I look at a coincidence through the spiritual eye and I see that this is part of God's big plan, that this person was placed in my life, when I don't, you know, when I see somebody I know, I'll stop and figure out, well, why is it that our paths are crossed? I'll stop and say, hey, what's going on? Instead of just, oh, that guy didn't see me, I'm in a hurry to get to the, you know, get to the meeting so I can talk about the spiritual life or something, you know? And I just pass this guy up that I haven't seen in a couple of years, instead of stopping and finding out. When I start relying on this stuff, I live a happier life doing that. You know, when I start getting cynical about the spiritual life, it's a bad thing for me. I'll hear somebody talk, oh, this great thing happened, and I'll be thinking, that's just a coincidence, you know. It's kind of tough. You know, I'm in spiritual trouble myself, and I don't care what people think, whether it's true or not true. I'm telling you, my life is a lot happier when I believe in this stuff than when I don't. And when I start relying on this stuff, and I've had it over and over and over again, these ideas of just when I had the thought of that I owed this person amends, that phone call came like Erica talked about, or that I had the intuitive thought or the inspiration to say a certain thing. And it's really, really vital in 12-step work to have that. I mean, I think that's really the point of work in these steps, is to try to get in touch with that inspiration, intuitive thought, so that we can be more on the plane of inspiration when it comes to working with others. And I'm going to just go back for just a quick second and just tell you a story of like not being inspired and not relying on inspiration and trying to just stick to the hard and fast rules. I'll tell you another one of these that you know, these deals didn't just come to me. You know, some of these were, you know, hard lessons for me. One of them is my friend Bob, who's still a member of my group. He still comes to my monthly meetings. I still sponsor him. And he's found it in his heart to forgive me for what I did to him. But he was a guy, when I was going through the amends, I owed a lot of money. And when I was in early sobriety, real early sobriety, like a month or two sober, I just went to the $125 bankruptcy or divorce guy, and he was like, well, what is it? You want bankruptcy or divorce? I'll say, I'll take the bankruptcy today, thank you, and here's my money. And okay, here's how it works. He says, you can take the kind of bankruptcy. He says,